Ideas matter. Ideas matter. This is Dialogue.
Hello and welcome to Dialogue. New Chinese ambassador to the U.S., Xie Feng, has arrived in the country this week to assume office, filling the position after months of vacancy. And the U.S. President Joe Biden suggested a thaw very shortly in terms of engagement with China. At the same time, China investigated and imposed bans on U.S. semiconductor company Micron Technology. Are the relations to improve anytime soon? Will the two countries be able to resolve their thorny issues so as to help stabilize the most critical relationship in the world? To further examine the ties between the two countries, I'm glad to be joined by Professor Huang Jing, Director of the Institute of the U.S. and the Pacific Studies in Shanghai International Studies University, Howard Zodan, Senior Fellow at Center for China and Globalization, and Bram Becker, author and show host of the Socialist Program on Breakthrough News. That's our topic. I'm Xu Qinduo. Welcome to Dialogue. On his arrival in Washington, actually in the U.S., in New York, I would say, Huang Jing, the new Chinese ambassador, Xie Feng, sent out two messages. You know, he said he's here to defend, to safeguard the interests of China, and he's there to enhance China-U.S. exchange and cooperation. I mean, it's rare to see the Chinese ambassador, Chinese officials being so open. I'm here to defend the Chinese interests. Of course, you know, he has a rich experience in terms of affairs related to China-U.S. relationship. So we are expecting better communication between the two countries.
I think, yes, if you compare his arrival in the speech with his predecessors, now the Minister of Qin Gang. When Qin Gang arrived in the United States about a year and a half ago, he said, I'm here trying to maintain a stable, productive, cooperative, and manageable relationship between the two countries. But now, obviously, the top priority for Xie Feng is to safeguard China's interests, which means that he tried to build up a kind of communication and cooperation, if possible, on the equal footing with the United States. Basically, we are equal. And of course, it is quite, you know, it's good. I mean, it's quite understandable for ambassador as a top representative of China and United States to safeguard China's interests. But for him to speak out, like you said, straightforward like this, is quite, in my view, unprecedented.
Mm-hmm. Well, Harvey, like, you know, with appointment, now we know that there's several months of vacancy of the ambassadorship here. Now the new ambassador arriving in D.C. What's the prospect of, let's say, communication, channel of communication between the two countries?
The new ambassador, as you said, has a wealth of experience dealing with the United States. And I was reminded in his remarks about what Secretary of State Blinken said early in his term about relations with China, that competitive when it should be, collaborative when it can be, and adversarial, you know, when it must be. So I think that kind of sums up China's relations as well with the United States. I think the new ambassador has his work cut out for him, though, because the knives are out for China in the Congress. No issue in America unites the whole country like being against China. And so the ambassador is going to face a significant amount of headwinds. But I believe because of his experience and his skill that he's going to do the best job he can. And I think that he'll try to open up a dialogue that's needed, especially after the last few months and the last few years. So I'm cautiously optimistic, I think you could say.
Cautiously optimistic. Brian, you know, given what Harvey has said, you know, if in particular, I guess, the Congress, you know, there's, you know, to be frank, the anti-China sentiment is really strong and high. And when it comes to the branch of the administration, can we see, you know, probably the White House is ready probably to talk to the ambassador and to the Chinese side to improve or to stabilize, if not improve, the relationship?
I mean, I think if we look at the situation objectively, starting with the first meeting between Blinken and Jake Sullivan and their counterparts in China back right in the beginning of the Biden administration in Alaska, we have to come to the conclusion that the Biden administration, the Biden White House, and the State Department itself has been a primary generator of the animus and hostility towards China. And the increasing tensions that have been created deliberately with a forethought on the part of the administration. So what we see in Congress and reflected in the U.S. mass media is not simply a pressure on the Biden White House, it's been generated by the Biden White House. This was a deliberate policy. And I think the Biden administration has taken a very aggressive steps, more aggressive than any other U.S. administration since Nixon came to China, since the signing of the Shanghai Communique, to ramp up tensions and to try to block by means of economic coercion China's continued rise as an economic force, China's decision and priority to grow economically and to expand its own peaceful relations and economic relations with others. So the Biden administration is now facing blowback because the Chinese have stood up and are taking, they didn't want to have animosity, they didn't want to have increased tension, but they're compelled to take these very strong positions. So I'm not optimistic. I think the Biden administration has been set back somewhat and wants to talk now and talk nice, but they're responsible for this current situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, Huang Jing, yes, we will come back to this, at least a change of tone, it seems, to be from the Biden administration. But anyway, look forward. The new ambassador, Xie Feng, said that, quote, "I remain convinced that a sound and stable China-U.S. relationship benefits both countries." So what's your take of, his remarks?
Of course, I do agree with Ambassador Xie Feng that a good relationship between the United States and China is good for both countries and both peoples. But reality, just like my colleague just said, is that there is a consensus on a kind of bashing China or anti-China in both Republicans and Democrats. And also the Biden administration, since it came to power, has adopted quite a few policies against China, because it said, like Blinken said at the very beginning, said a major part of the China policy is to compete or outcompete China. In that regard, I think that it is very, I'm not sure that we can really improve the U.S.-China relationship in a kind of fundamental way, even though, of course, President Biden just said he wants the relationship to be improved. But another reason, another factor in this is that the Biden administration is not a very strong administration. Actually, it's very weak. What it wants, what it wishes to do is quite different from what it's capable of doing, and especially after the midterm elections and now the relationship with Congress. So I think that the problem right now is that if Biden administration can deliver what it wants to, even though it may want to improve the relationship between the two great powers.
Mm-hmm. Harvey, I want to have your opinions. Of course, we have witnessed in recent, weeks from the U.S. side, senior officials talking about, trips to China or possible trips to China, improving or stabilizing ties between the two countries. And recently, President Biden said that, he believes a thaw in relationship will come very shortly. Are you that optimistic?
I'm wondering what President Biden is talking about, because he faces so much congressional blowback on anything positive that he does about China. Now that the Chinese and American trade officials are going to meet at a high level, maybe, but it's unlikely that there could be some long shot relaxation of trade. You have to remember that President Trump imposed very draconian tariffs on China, and Biden has continued them. But now, especially after the G7 on the weekend, it's hard to see any breakthroughs, however welcome that they would be. All I know is that we sorely need confidence-building measures and have to start communicating, as my other colleagues have said just a few moments ago, we have to start communicating better on issues where our national interests overlap, like climate change, global public health, and even now a new one, the promise and perils of AI, artificial intelligence, because computers are starting to show signs of thinking for themselves. So we have a full plate that we should be addressing, but we're putting our energy still too much into criticizing each other, and that's not good.
Mm-hmm. Brian, earlier you mentioned about the White House or U.S. side is somehow compelled to. I'm not sure which word to use. Either change or shift the tone simply toward China. At the same time, we are seeing increasing communication. For example, the Chinese Commerce Minister Wang Wentao will meet his U.S. counterpart in D.C. and also Catherine Tai, the trade representative in Detroit. So at least in trade section, tell us more about your understanding and how, in what way China has stood out the U.S. pressure probably, and then that forced Washington probably to recognize or to compromise with the reality?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Chinese position has been increasingly assertive because to do otherwise would be really a sign of weakness on the part of China because there's nothing matching the U.S. animus towards China inside of China. There's not like the legislative branch and the other parts of the Chinese system of governance that are uniting to, every day make damning speeches about the United States, to insist that there can never be real economic relations, to insist, as U.S. politicians are doing, that the worst mistake that the U.S. ever made was to, quote, let China into the World Trade Organization. I mean, these inflammatory, belligerent statements become a self-fulfilling prophecy in the years after the U.S. Has decided to make major power conflict its top priority. First, it was identified as such in the Pentagon Doctrine in 2018. And then almost without debate, all of the different sectors and institutions of power in America have adopted the same theme that we must be adversaries fundamentally. And yes, there can be a thought from time to time, but it doesn't derail the basic concept that we're basically enemies. And this is such a fundamental change in the last 10 or 15 years. And again, without debate, like, is this a good idea? Is this smart? Should the U.S. be ramping up for competition and conflict with China in all spheres? I mean, I think most American people actually don't want that, but their voices are unheard in the middle of this very intense anti-China chorus.
Mm-hmm. Speak of that, Harvey, recently, I think the CEO of NVIDIA, the U.S. semiconductor company, speak in the interview, he said that probably he questioned the wisdom of the U.S. Pressure or the U.S. practice of banning export of advanced chips to the Chinese side. He said basically that's created an opening for the Chinese side to be more self-reliant and to do research and produce their own advanced chips. I want to know, what was your take on that?
Well, my take is that necessity is the mother of invention. And if the U.S. And its allies, whether the allies are willing or cowed by the United States, China has to do more to be self-reliant. And it is doing more to be self-reliant. And I think an interesting case in point is Huawei. Look, President Trump started to demonize Huawei and even had the Huawei CFO, the daughter of the founder, arrested at the same time that Trump was having dinner with Xi Jinping at the G20. So that's pretty bad. And Huawei has been blocked by having access to U.S. technology, to microchips and things. So what did Huawei do when the Americans thought they were going to destroy it? Huawei changed course and used its 5G technology to come up with very innovative solutions and is doing much better now than before when the U.S. thought that they would kill it. So I think that because necessity is the mother of invention, that China is prepared to meet these challenges. But I don't see a world that's completely decoupled or even de-risked completely, because we live in a globalized world. We can't operate with walls between us. So I believe that we're going to get along as best we can, and we have to if there's going to be any future for our children and for our grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. Huang Jing, you know, speak of the de-risking, you know, the phrase has become popular, at least, you know, especially in the West. The G7 statement, for example, they are trying to adjust their China policy from one of decoupling to one of de-risking. What's the difference then? What's de-risking and what are the risks? Can they do that or will they do that? Simply, you know, talking about de-risking, but actually it's still decoupling?
I think de-risking is just this new political rhetoric or new term that I do not believe even the people in Washington, D.C. or the Germans who invented this term really understand what it is, or they have a kind of a consensus of what de-risking really is. If de-risking means that in terms of security issue, China is not a country that posted all the military forces all over the world. China is not a country who has a military base. Bases all over the world, you know, why China is a threat to anybody else. Even in terms of economic threat, that is even more funny because just like the previous colleague said, globalization, economic globalization is not a result of any country's policy or strategy. It was driven by market forces because market forces always want the most efficient distribution of resources, the highest rate of production, and the highest profit. It's a market forces are driven globalization. I do not believe United States can really do with all the walls built up around itself, because like I said, we all live in a very much globalized world, especially if you ask me what is the most globalized industry too. Number one, finance or capital. Number two, high tech. This is the fact. But now we do see we discuss some senior officials of United States, including President Biden, want to so-called improve relationship with China because two common ground emerged between the two countries. Number one is a global financial stability. And number two, perhaps, is a management of this very fast developing artificial intelligence. I think the two countries do have responsibility and a common interest to manage both of them because it is very, very important areas for human beings as well.
Mm-hmm. Huang Jing, you know, I wonder how do you characterize the Chinese response so far, you know, over the past couple of years since Donald Trump starting this trade war on China. And recently China has imposed bans on the U.S. company Micron Technology. Is it an isolated case, or you know, is that some would say that's the Chinese retaliation against, of course, many more U.S. sanctions on the Chinese side?
I think this entire thing is a computational rivalry. Is initiated by the American side first by Donald Trump and reinforced the more systematic by the Biden administration. Everybody can see that China always want to maintain a good relationship. China will not initiate anything conflicting with the United States. But China, as a big power with its own interests, have to defend its own interests. So I think right now, China's attitude is very simple. China does not initiate any confrontations, conflict vis-a-vis United States, but China is not afraid standing up against United States, where China does have its own interest defense. About this Micron, of course, what China did is mainly, if compared to what United States did, is just the minimum, because Micron did do something that against China's interest. This is obvious. That's a lot of evidence shows that. But United States, we just talk about Huawei and all those companies on the list of United States to boycott or try. I think that we know where the blame should be put. I do not believe United States can have this kind of hypocritic or double standard carry on while trying to claim that it's a victim. I think that's really a little bit ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Brian, you know, there's a talk of or reports saying that the U.S. side seeking meeting with the Chinese defense minister on the sideline of the Shangri-La dialogue upcoming in Singapore. And then there's a contradictory signal, coming out from different U.S. department. You know, I think the White House said that the U.S. will lift sanctions on the Chinese defense minister. And then there's a denial from the State Department. So what's happening in this regard?
Yeah, it's kind of like the United States has decided we're going to talk and fight at the same time. And I think the talk is largely, in a way, kind of camouflage. Like the U.S. imposes sanctions wrongly on the defense leader in China, and then says, "But perhaps we'll lift the sanctions," as if that's a goodwill gesture, when those sanctions should have never been imposed. And so you have a kind of a hardball, bullying kind of diplomacy, where the bully says after they punch you, "But let's talk. Let's think about what we can do to improve relations," after they just punched you in the face. So is it really a goodwill gesture, or is it designed really to keep China sort of off balance? And I think there's a little bit of fear on the part of the Biden administration that this extreme animus and hostility and open brazen hostility towards China on so many levels has a geopolitical outcome too, where it pushes China closer and closer to others who the U.S. also considers to be adversaries, like in particular Russia. And you can see the Russian-Chinese statements after the G7. That is obviously concerning to the United States, because the United States would like to separate China from Russia at the moment that the U.S. has decided to try to weaken both countries. So there's a geostrategic, geopolitical a focus here, not simply economic, and simply not related to, and not only related to U.S.-China relations, but sort of a global geostrategic presentation being made by Washington.
Mm-hmm. Well, Harvey, as Brian said, the U.S. side is trying to play both sides. But then, you know, of course, they has been pushing for talks for the so-called smooth communication channels here. But then, you know, the Chinese side of the concern is like, what, you know, are we going to talk about? Probably it's simply for, you know, talk for talk's sake. What are the substantial issue? Or is there any readiness to make any concessions? For example, lifting sanctions on the Chinese products? I mean, low-hanging fruit for both sides probably to pick here?
It's not obvious, but, you know, Biden gave us a hint in the press conference about some kind of relaxation in U.S. activities against China. So I think we're all waiting to see what he's going to do. But you're right. In order to continue to have dialogues, it's not good just to meet and not make any progress, or it's not good to just meet and just scream at each other or talk past each other. So we need to start by having a conversation about things where our national interests overlap. And as I said before, these include things like the environment, global public health, the good and bad of AI, and so on. And we're not having those conversations enough. And so in some ways, we're not seeing the forest for the trees. And I think we both need to get serious and go back to where we were before Trump screwed things up, when our relationship was quite good, when we had strategic and economic dialogues. We're not going to have those dialogues anytime in the near future, but we need to have starting to have some kinds of dialogues and on some kinds of issues where we can move the ball forward, because we're the two most powerful countries in the world. We owe it to the world to do something.
Mm-hmm. Huang Jing, you know, one of the top issues between the two countries is the Taiwan question. Recently, U.S. Admiral John Aquilino, commander of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, said in a speech that the China-U.S. conflicts are not inevitable. U.S. policies related to Taiwan have not changed, and the U.S. does not seek an independent Taiwan, quote unquote. But he said, you know, we are still seeing, you know, at the same time, from the Chinese side, the concern is like we are still seeing, you know, arms sales to Taiwan. And of course, the U.S. is building the higher level trade ties with Taiwan. This is also, you know, the concern related to the issue. You know, at the G7 summit, also in the statement they talked about, they said they have not changed their policy on Taiwan. They still stick to this one China policy. Had the U.S. shifted or changed its policy regarding Taiwan?
I think that it doesn't matter what you say, it matters what you do. I think in recent years, we see that two very dangerous tendencies regarding Taiwan, U.S.-Taiwan policy. One is that the United States seems to slime the salami, right, a little by little, not only increase both volumes and quality and quantity of the arms sale to Taiwan, but also quite a few things which are unthinkable now become reality. For example, Pelosi visited Taiwan, the number three person in U.S. Government, when so McCarthy just met with Tsai Ing-wen, and also Tsai Ing-wen has visited United States and so on and so forth. All of this, of course, is kind of almost cross the line of one China policy. But now you said, okay, we don't want to fight, we don't support Taiwan independence. But meanwhile, you did a lot of things that cross the almost crossing line. And that's one. Another one is that what to me is very dangerous is it seems Congress seems to be more and more active in Taiwan policy, in the making of Taiwan policy. In other words, Congress is pushing the White House on Taiwan policy. It's adopted quite a few laws in the past few years on Taiwan, which is very, very dangerous. I do not see the capability or even willingness of the White House to contain the Congress, which, of course, is very dangerous in that regard. We always say the bad cop and the good cop, but what if the good cop failed to manage the bad cop? So like my colleagues in United States, we may sleepwalk into a war on the Taiwan issue. It's very dangerous. In other words, you cannot just keep playing with fire. I say, oh, I don't want the fire, but you just keep playing the fire. I think the ball, like in the larger picture, the relationship between United States and China, the ball is in Washington, D.C. now.
Well, with that, we come to the end of today's show. Many thanks to our guests. I'm Xu Qinduo. Thanks for being with us. See you next time.
You're listening to the Beijing Hour, 60 minutes of comprehensive news, your window on China and the world.
Deep Dive, a podcast of CGTN Radio. We go beyond headlines with reporters from around the world. Search for Deep Dive on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen. Take a deep dive into the news every week. Hear our conversations.